From the Sky News Centre at 5. Large parts of England are officially in drought after the driest spring since records began. The counties affected are Cambridgeshire, Northamptonshire, Norfolk and Lincolnshire. Water companies believe there won't be widespread restrictions to the public, but the lack of water has already hit crop yields. Richard Dodd from the British Retail Consortium says this could affect food prices.
It's adding to the upward pressures that are already there on food prices, things like rising world demand and increasing production costs. But I think it'd be easy to exaggerate how significant it is, because actually, you know, we rarely get a year when the weather is perfect for farmers.
The bodies of a 28-year-old woman and a 5-year-old child have been discovered in Warwickshire. Police say they were at an address in Stratford-upon-Avon. Tributes are being paid to Ireland's former finance minister, Brian Lenehan, who's died. The 52-year-old had been battling pancreatic cancer for 18 months. His family say his health had deteriorated rapidly over the past few weeks. Ed Bowles has denied he plotted with Gordon Brown to force Tony Blair out of office. Documents released today show correspondence between the two former prime ministers negotiating terms of the handover of leadership. Ed Miliband is also believed to have been involved in the plot. The former editor of the New Statesman, John Kampfner, says this could damage the current Labour leader.
It's hard for him to show people, look, we've all moved on, this isn't Brown, this isn't Blair, because although he had only a minor part, he was the mini-me to Ed Bowles in the Brown camp.
In tennis, Andy Murray has breezed into the semi-finals at Queen's. He's been given a bye after opponent Marin Cilic pulled out of the tournament with an ankle injury. And one of the UK's biggest computer game developers has confirmed the personal details of many of its customers have been stolen. Codemasters has had their systems hacked and email addresses and customer names have been leaked. That's the latest. I'm Adam Lindsay.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's weekly politics show, Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling, and helping us review the news this week is newly elected Labour councillor for Eastville, Mahmoud Khan. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is along too. After the 6 o'clock news, if you've never heard of the annual Bilderberg conference, it's because, like bankers or the Wizard of Oz, they want to stay out of the spotlight. And the amazing thing is, most of our press go along with the cover-up. Well, the West's 120 richest bankers, bosses and royalty are schmoozing politicians, including UK Chancellor George Osborne today, inside a secret annual four-day conference in Switzerland. The media moguls inside are sworn to secrecy and the reporters outside are banned. Well, we ask, why the secrecy? Why is it not on the BBC News? And asked to hear, and we also hear live from The Guardian's Charlie Skelton and We Are Change Birmingham's John Scobie, who are at the scene of the crime. And as the annual Farms Open Day comes up, I'll be listening to some of the Bristol farms open to family visitors this Sunday. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Lows of 3 Celsius tonight and some rain. This weekend, temperatures are up to 16 Celsius, sunnier on Saturday and windier and wetter on Sunday. Next week, highs of 16 Celsius, sunnier towards the beginning of the week, wetter towards the end of the week, rather like the weekend actually, isn't it? And next weekend, that's the 18th and 19th of June, highs, well, if you can call them that, up to 13 Celsius. Not very good, is it, for the time of year? Sunnier and showers, and that's next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. And time to introduce this week's guest, who is Labour councillor for Eastville, Mahmoud Khan. Hi, Mahmoud, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, now, thank you.
Tell us about yourself, because you've only just got elected to the City Council, haven't you?
Exactly, yeah. Well, as you said, my name, Mahmoud Khan, and I've just been elected this year, May the 5th. I have been with Labour Party quite a few years.
So what's your background? Are you a family man?
No, I'm not married yet. Yeah.
Okay. What have you been doing before you got into Bristol City politics?
Well, I'm in catering industry. I had few businesses in around Bristol, and I still have business.
Okay.
Still,
yeah. So how did you make the leap from catering into politics? What made you decide you wanted to get involved in the political scene?
Well, it's always been in my system, I think. I ran my first election at the age of 13 in the school election, you know, like school council election. And since then, I done it in the college, and here I am.
So what do you think you can bring to politics? What's your vision?
Well, the vision is to serve people rightly, you know, and tell the truth.
Okay, so why did you choose the Labour Party and not one of the other parties?
Well, I think this is the party who speaks for majority rather than minority.
Well, yes, but I'm afraid if you look at the general election results from last year, most people actually didn't vote for Labour, did they? They voted for the Lib Dems or the Conservatives.
Well, the amounts of vote that I think Labour Party was ahead. Yet, if you think about the situation was during the election, I think still, I mean, it is my belief that still Labour Party was able to achieve much better than everybody expected that Tory will do. So,
okay, so what is your vision for this city particularly then? What do you think are the things in Bristol that you can make a difference about?
Well, I mean, like, as you know, it's not just an individual thing, it's a collective thing. City Council has to take the decisions. I would like to see cities' transport developed. I would like to see crime gone down. I would like to see this city as an international city. I would like to see it is really became an international city. There are a lot of other issues in our city. Like many other cities, we have prostitutions, we have other things that we need to get rid of it and bring this city as international standard and livable for us and our generation to come, you know, make it better and better. Yeah.
Okay, what committees are you on then? What sort of part do you play in those?
Well, as you know, I've just been elected, and being in committees and all this is huge lot of jobs and understanding involved and all this. It's not just fun that you go and sit in a committee. I'm going to be sitting in planning, and I'm going to be just watching for a little while, you know, like that, how things happening and who's doing what and not. So basically, scrutiny committee, one of these committee, overall scrutiny that I will sit quite often, though I'm not a member, but I will sit, I'll watch so that I get a flavor of what's happening, you know, like all across the city.
Well, planning is always a hot issue because we've got both of these big stadiums being planned for the city. Both the Bristol City Football Club and Bristol Rovers now have also announced that they want to build a big new stadium up at the University of the West of England. So what will be your thoughts initially, before you've actually even been part of this committee, on those big developments?
Well, I mean, I would say we need some sort of stadium or something for the city.
But we've already got two stadiums. Why are we going to knock those ones down and build another one?
I think
another two, and yeah, that's what they're proposing.
Well, I'm not talking about two or one. I think we need facilities whereby we can do much more arena-type things, you know, I mean, whereby people come from all over the country or world and observe some brilliant occasions here, you know. I mean, these cities are not able to hold all these events that we would like to see for our, you know, for our city.
But with Bristol City Football Club, for example, they've got a perfectly good stadium which sits idle most of the time. I mean, surely those events could already be taking place down in Southville.
Well, I think it hasn't happened. And I think with the time now, I think we need a new approach, a new place, a new, you know, a fresh start where, you know, people has that like, oh, you know, let's go to Wembley or let's go to somewhere else, you know, like that, you know, Birmingham. So that place need to be there. People need to get associates, and then people need to organize those events and, you know, like.
But looking at this bit of news this week about the new planned stadium for the University of the West of England area, I mean, this looks to me like all they're doing is just copying what Bristol City have done, and that has been there simply to dig them out of a terrible financial hole they're in. And part of the reason that they're in the financial hole is because they're not using the stadium as well as they could be, the one that they've got that exists. And if they can get planning permission on a nice field, which is very cheap, suddenly their value of the football club goes up massively overnight. So by awarding them planning permission, you could also be just sort of donating millions of pounds to these football clubs and blighting the local residents who don't want a big stadium next to their homes.
Well, I'm sure they haven't applied yet. I mean, you know, if they have applied and if I am in the planning, I will see, you know. I mean, obviously it has to be balanced. You cannot just anybody applying for some sort of stadium or whatever permission, you cannot just allow them, you know, just because, okay, it's going to be a development and so on. There is a lot of things to look at, you know.
Okay, well, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is along too, as usual.
Hi, Martin.
And a letter from the economists at Martin on Sunday in The Observer talks of a plan B being absolutely necessary for Britain. But also we've heard the IMF chief, and we'll be hearing him in a minute, explaining that he doesn't think we need a plan B, that the economy's fine. So can you just help us see the light at the end of the tunnel here, because they're both saying completely opposite things.
Yes, and one lot of people are right and the other lot of people are wrong. The independent economists who say we need a plan B are correct, and the IMF are, as usual, in the wrong.
Why is wrong about the IMF? The IMF, Martin, are world experts in finance.
No, they're not. They made exactly the wrong call. They've had to admit that the independent economists have said that the economy was stagnant. This time, 3 months ago, the IMF was saying we were going to have growth in Britain. They were proved wrong. And if you look at the track record of the IMF over the last 30 years, they've been wrong about just about everything in every country where they've stuck their fingers. They are basically debt collectors for Wall Street. They are not independent at all. They are basically redundant, and in fact the IMF is going to have to be abolished, as John Smith called for years ago.
Well, after the Observer, as I said, delivered a broadside from leading British economists condemning Chancellor George Osborne's policies on Sunday, the acting head of the IMF, John Lipsky, stepped in to his defence on Monday. And of course, this is John Lipsky is actually only running the IMF because of the demise of Dominique Strauss-Kahn. So let's have a listen to what John Lipsky had to say on Monday.
Growth has flattened in recent quarters, really as spiking energy and commodity prices, together with a still weak housing market, has weighed on consumer confidence. At the same time, as we know, headline inflation has accelerated, reflecting both the spike in commodity prices and the indirect tax hikes. Now, naturally, these developments raise the question whether it's time to adjust the macroeconomic policy strategy. And according to IMF staff analysis, the answer is no. We expect that the deviations from the economic trajectory that had been forecast to be largely temporary.
Largely temporary. Well, that's what they would say. As Mandy, in the mortal words of Mandy Rice Davis, that's what they would say, isn't it? They've got it wrong. They've calculated wrong. The economy is not growing. And now they're saying it's only temporary. It will grow. They're wrong. They're just wrong.
Mahmoud, what are your thoughts about this whole tussle on the economy? Do you think we should be cutting in the way that George Osborne and the IMF think we should?
No. Well, by cutting economy, obviously that the Tory party has taken this initiative, and you can see after a year of this government what's happening around the country. The market confidence is lowest ever. The people are losing the job. The families are suffering. The elderly are, you know, like the reduce of their state, all these benefits and facilities. The children with disabled people, you know, children with young families, everybody. And people like us in small businesses, we are suffering even the worst. Because if people don't have money, we don't survive, small businesses, you know. So I think that the economic, this strategy is failed, totally failed. You cannot go on suffocating people and keep saying that, keep breathing.
Okay, yeah. One of the other things that John Lipsky was talking about there is that he's saying that actually good regulation of the financial markets is on the horizon. So what about bank regulation? And is the Independent Commission on Banking, which has been set up by the new government, really up to the job? One of the main members of the commission is the Independent Commission on Banking, is a former Secretary General of the Bilderberg Group, who you heard about at the beginning of the programme. We'll be talking about also in the second half after six. And his name's Martin Taylor. Here he is a few weeks ago in front of the Treasury Select Committee talking about what the Independent Commission on Banking are going to be doing about regulation.
If the regulators, as they all say they're going to, really watch a number of these simultaneously, it's going to be harder for the banks to cheat.
But this isn't the regulators. This is the supervisors.
I'm sorry, I mean supervisors.
The question I was going to ask is, are the supervisors good enough?
It is certainly a mistake to suppose that improvement in supervision solves all problems. The number of people who are trying to evade the restrictions greatly exceeds the number of people who are trying to stop them. The incentives for the number of people who are trying to evade them greatly exceed the incentives for those who are trying to stop them. And human ingenuity is unbounded. So supervision, though admirable, and we all want better macroprudential supervision, and we certainly want it.
Martin Summers, this is a crucial issue, this whole business of regulating the banks, isn't it? What do you think of what you heard there?
Well, as you said, we're not talking about regulation here, we're talking about supervision. What strikes me as absolutely extraordinary is that the banks are claiming to make profits on the basis of fraudulent accounting, basically. Enron-style accounting has become normal in the banking industry. If they were made to mark to market the junk that they are holding, all of the banks would not just be illiquid, they would be insolvent. And it's not a question of, you don't regulate an insolvent organisation, you wind it up. And we're having a non-debate about whether we should regulate the private banking system, when in actual fact what we need to do is sack the existing managers and wind up the existing banking system and build something more sensible.
Do you think to a certain extent we've got a situation here where some of the terminology and the whole business of banking is so boring that actually people don't really want to even get to grips with the problem? Because what we're hearing from Martin Taylor, who's a former head of Barclays Bank, is that there's so many bankers around and they always find a way to get around the rules.
Yes, that's why we've got to get basically put an end to the game. Once we bailed out the banks in 2008, the game should have been up for them. Why are they still there? Why are they still telling us what to do? We own them. They wouldn't be there at all if we hadn't banked
them. Well, we don't own Barclays, do we?
Well, we do indirectly, because Barclays is owed loads of money by the other banks we do owe. And if they were to collapse, then Barclays would collapse as well. It's a systemic system. It's a system all of a piece. And Barclays claiming that they're solvent because they got handouts from the Gulf states. Meanwhile, they're owed loads of money by all the other banks, and if they were to collapse, Barclays would go down too. The whole banking system is basically bust, and denial is not just a river in Egypt. We're still talking nonsense about this, and nobody has got the will or the strength to take them on. And that's a real democratic deficit in this country and in the United States. People hoped that Obama was going to kick them into shape, but the biggest contributors to Obama's election campaign were Goldman Sachs, and more than 50% of his money came from Wall Street. And he's put Tim Geithner in charge of his economic policy. Bernanke's still there at the Federal Reserve. They're both Republicans, and they're both Republican bankers. Why are they still there? It's because Obama basically is bought, as are most of the politicians around the world.
Now, Mahmoud Khan, hopefully you're not bought. You're a local politician here. Nah. What would you do if you were in the shoes of the Treasury Select Committee there? Because they're trying to grapple there with a crucial issue, which is the financial regulation. What would you like to see?
Well, the regulation has to be done. You know, I mean, if you look at these banks' chiefs, the millions of pounds they're taking, describe this is the day-to-day, they're sitting there and all they are doing is planning how to con us, how to con the people of this country, you know, and the people of world. And so we are paying for people who are sitting in a top class place and thinking how to con us. We are paying them billions of dollars. I think this is shame on us.
So, yeah, but the problem here is that Martin Taylor says there is that there are thousands of bankers and banking traders, and yet there's just a handful of people that are likely to regulate them, even in the future. So how are we going to do something about that? Because the bankers seem to be outnumbering the regulators.
Well, I mean, like, obviously, you know, governments is always stronger in a stronger position. I know bankers are in some sort of some strength. They have some strength, but the governments is nobody is above governments. I think the you know, I would say, I know you might then come back to me. I think the governments and the politicians across the board, I think, has a moral duty to do something about it, for not only thinking that, well, not only thinking that how we can sustain and survive for 10 years or 15 years or 5 years in the government, but how our generation will be sustained. We need to think about that. And if we leave it like this, and if we leave it too long, unless we start something now, nothing happens overnight. We got to, someone got to start something about these bank issues. Otherwise, we will have another, you know, even before we recover from this one, we will have another recession.
Because, you know? Martin, it's rather similar hearing what we with the Independent Commission on Banking. It doesn't really seem to be very independent to begin with. And this is exactly what the Conservatives were complaining about when Labour were in office, that Labour weren't getting tough enough, and now it seems the Conservatives aren't prepared to. Who is going to take on the bankers?
Well, this is a real political problem all over the world. Who is going to take them on? I mean, one would look to the President of the United States. I mean, in the 1930s, Franklin Delano Roosevelt certainly did take on the banks. And what he said, Wall Street hates me and I welcome their hatred because I represent the people. And he faced them down. Obama is not Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Well, what about David Cameron? Is he going to do it?
Well, since he was born as the son of a hedge fund manager with a silver spoon in his mouth, who's a millionaire the day he was born, I think the answer is no.
Well, one of the spin-offs for all of this financial situation is that Grant Shapps, he's the Conservative housing minister, and here he is this week explaining how he intends to get the house builders to build homes and more homes during this economic slump, because the government has had to massively cut back its subsidy towards social housing. So here's housing minister Grant Shapps.
How much of this is going to be social housing?
Well, that's up to the combination of what comes forward. And I agree with Campbell when he says that, you know, under the old system, top-down targets and the rest of it, house building collapsed to the lowest level since the 1920s. We have to do better than that. We're putting incentives in place so that communities actually get something back when they build. That's the new homes bonus. This announcement today says, look, there are all these departments around Whitehall. They sit on land. Actually, a lot of it, we don't even know where it is. There's not even a single database that you can look at. Let's get that together. And let's get homes built. And I want homes of all types. I want them to be for sale.
So
I want them to be
land,
for social
homes.
Sell
it, are you going to sell it at cost, market rate? Or are you going to sell it off a bit?
We're actually
going to
do a bunch of different things. So first thing you mentioned, build now, pay later, where one of the problems for the builders at the moment is their cash flow is being shot to bits by having this lowest building rates. So we're going to say you can build the land and then build the homes, sell the homes and pay for it afterwards. But another thing we're going to try are land auctions. Now, this is where you competitively auction down the value of land by saying, two plots next to each other, put your land in, but if you've bid too high or you're asking too much, you won't get it.
You've cut the budget by 60%.
Houses take a long time to build, you don't get
160,000 homes were cancelled by you in the last year and by the local authority. So you're talking about 100,000 today. It's not even going to make up for the ones that were cancelled by you.
That was actually not all Grant Shapps, because that was the shadow housing minister, the Labour housing minister at the end there. Mahmoud, what are your thoughts about this plan to sell off land cheaply to housing developers to actually kickstart the housing market? Because there's not enough homes being built at the moment because of the financial slump.
Well, I mean, like, you cannot... We need to build houses. I think this government is not saying something clear about... Like, they're not saying anything clear about economy. They're not saying anything clear about housing. It's a big issue, and you know, I mean, it's not going to work just by selling cheap to developers. You know, there is a lot of other things involved there, and giving some incentive, I think it's not going to work.
Martin?
Yeah, I think it isn't going to work. I mean, as the Shadow Housing Minister was pointing out there, 160,000 houses are not being built. They've cut the budget by 60%. What interests me is what Ed Balls said during the Labour leadership campaign. I didn't vote for Ed Balls, but I'm rather pleased to see him as Shadow Chancellor now, because I think he's actually got the intellectual ability for the job. But one of the things he said was perhaps what we need to have is a whole new generation of council housing. Whole new generation of council housing. Now, that's music to my ears. It's the first time I've heard a senior Labour figure say anything like that in 30 years. And, of course, that's the way to kickstart the economy. You've got all these people on the dole who know how to build houses, all these poor people who need houses. There's got to be affordable houses. You see, giving land to developers, they're just going to build luxury flats on it. Yeah, that's not going to house the homeless.
Exactly.
We need to build council houses, affordable to people, accountable to local authorities, and put people to work doing it.
But Martin, Ed Balls is only saying that as a bit of electioneering in the Labour leadership campaign.
No, I think the Labour leadership campaign brought out some very interesting arguments. He said that. Andy Burnham also, who I thought was a Blairite, waste of space, frankly, he came out and said, well, perhaps we'll have to talk about things like land value taxation. And now what's beginning to bubble up here is the first glimmer of a real debate about the economy, which we haven't had for 30 years. And we need to go back and look at what Labour governments used to be about, what they used to do. They built thousands and thousands of council houses for people. They helped people who were in poor circumstances. They built the economy up. We need to go back to those days, the good old days.
OK, our next story, David Cameron. Well, the Archbishop Rowan Williams is wrong on many levels, he said, very, very quickly after the Archbishop of Canterbury launched a bit of a campaign against David Cameron. The Prime Minister said that Rowan Williams was free to express his concerns, but insisted the government was acting in a good and moral fashion. Now, also in The Guardian this today, basically what Rowan Williams was saying was that rather than just simply not fulfilling manifesto pledges, that a lot of what the Conservative government is doing is damaging for the poor and wasn't even declared in the election. But The Guardian today, in its editorial, says at the heart of Rowan Williams' comments is a shrewd and important observation. His central contention is that the sense of a society underpinned by mutual responsibility, the essence of Beveridge, has been in decline for decades. Certainly since his predecessor Robert Runcie tackled Mrs. Thatcher about it 30 years ago, and is now on the point of collapse. One piece of evidence for this is the way in which welfare reform is discussed, and the reappearance of the Victorian ideas about poverty when he calls the seductive language of the deserving and the undeserving poor. Now, Martin, first of all, a little history lesson from you, if we may. What does he mean by bringing up the idea of Beveridge?
Well, Beveridge was a Liberal minister in the coalition government that ran Britain during the war, and he wrote the Beveridge Report, which was basically the basis of the modern welfare state in this country. Cradle-to-grave support for everybody. And, of course, it was passed at the end of the war because everybody realised that there had been huge shared sacrifice by the whole community and that the whole community should benefit by the victory that we'd won.
So what are your thoughts on Rowan Williams and David Cameron?
Well, you won't be surprised to learn that I agree with Rowan Williams and I don't agree with David Cameron. I think it's very brave of Rowan Williams to speak out. He's taken a lot of stick from the Tory press for speaking out, but he's saying no more than is absolutely obvious. Most of what's being proposed for the health service and in education was not in the Conservative manifesto. In fact, David Cameron went before the people at the election and said, there will be no top-down reform of the health service. Read my lips. And as soon as he comes to power, they start talking about bringing all these American private companies, more competition. We've just seen Southern Cross collapse, who are looking after elderly
people.
Well,
they're in a state of collapse, yeah.
And that is what privatised healthcare looks like. The privatised people go bust, and then the state has to step in and pick up the pieces at even further expense. Now, the Conservatives need to go away and have a word with themselves about this. They didn't have to do any of this. If they just basically done what Labour would have done in power but just called it conservatism, the country would probably be satisfied with them. But I'm afraid they are ideological to the core. They really think that this is the time to push their pet projects.
You say ideological, Martin. What are their ideals then?
Well, their ideals is private sector good, public sector bad. It's as if nothing has happened in the last 5 years. The private banking system has collapsed, capitalism is in crisis, and they just say, oh, what we need is more capitalism, isn't it? And the answer to that is no.
Well, Labour Councillor Mahmoud Khan, what are your thoughts about this little tussle between, actually they've called it the Canterbury Tales of The Guardian today, between Rowan Williams, Archbishop of Canterbury.
My mother is a priest and she'll be very happy with
well,
that.
I think it's a brave man, Mr. William, Rowan Williams. He's a brave man. He always speaks out what is truth, you know, always the case. And as you know, I mean, like, look, this government has put a... I mean, it was good that they done this AV referendum, I would say to the government that why don't they put a referendum on this issue and see whether the majority of this people in this country, which is we already know, that absolutely the majority people want that, or telling this government don't touch it. But they just, I think the health secretary and David Cameron, and obviously those private investors that who want this to be privatized and who have able to convince David Cameron and his colleague and his secretary of state, I think they would be happy. But I think it's not going to work. It would be a disaster. The people who are involved in day-to-day in this profession, they're telling that don't touch it. You know, so I think Mr. Cameron and his Secretary of State has a great deal to think about it before they do anything. And I have all the admiration for this gentleman, Ron William.
Yes, well, the thing is, surely you shouldn't really be mixing up religion and politics. I mean, they're two separate issues. And David Cameron, he's won a general election with a bit of help from the Liberals. He surely should now be able to do what he wants.
Well, Mr. Ron William is not just a religious figure. You know, he is a figure and he has all the rights to talk about people of this country. And this is what only he is doing. He's saying that we're going to be in trouble with this reform and all this. This is what it's like, your duty, my duty and his duty. So he's just performing his duty in a reasonable position, you know.
Okay. And now we're joined by Marina Morris. What have you got for us this week, Marina?
Hello. Child poverty strategy. The government has recently published its child poverty strategy to tackle the roots causes of poverty and end generational benefits dependency. The cornerstone of the strategy is a universal credit to subsidize the incomes of workers on low wage that lift them and their families out of poverty. When parents can't work, reforms to disability payments will apparently ensure that people are able to live in dignity, this unconditional support, and the unemployed will be helped through the work program. The chief executive of Child Poverty Action Group, Alison Graham, welcomed new figures from DWP, Department of Work and Pensions, showing child poverty at its lowest level in 25 years. She said that there are the final figures from the previous government's time in office. David Cameron must keep his promise to make British poverty history and to make sure the fall in child poverty continues. But cuts to public services, tax credits and child care support means fewer people will be better off in work. There's fewer jobs to go around. The DWP website promises that introduction of the universal credit will make work pay, lifting almost a million people out of poverty, including 350,000 children and 200,000 from severe poverty. Are these empty promises? Can this strategy work without action to tackle the lack of jobs, poor pay, unaffordable childcare, and the critical shortage of poor condition of social housing? A baby born to a low-income family from April 2011 will be around £1,500 worse off compared to the sibling born in April 2010. Losses: £190 health in pregnancy grant, £500 maternity grant, £500 child trust fund, £500 £45 baby element. Gains: £555 in child elements of children tax credit. This year benefits cut include Sure Start maternity grant limited to the first child only, child benefits rates frozen for the 3 years, other benefits except state pensions to be operated using consumer prices index, and housing benefits in private rents to be reduced for new claimants. Benefit strategy clearly has a role in the relief of extreme poverty. Behind this pint, this seems to be more stick than carrot, but is tough love an answer to benefit dependency, or are the weakest, most vulnerable members of society being asked to suffer a disproportionate share of the national pain?
Thanks very much, Marina. Now, Mahmoud Khan, Labour councillor for Eastville. Tough love, we hear from Marina there, is what's coming on. And also quite a lot of cuts to the benefits. I think one of the most shocking things that Marina was talking about there was how many benefits are being lost this year compared to last year for every baby which is born into a family which is under the poverty line. So what do you think? Tough love?
Well, yes, it is tough love. As Martin was saying, you know, Prime Minister and a lot of his colleagues was born in with a silver spoon or gold spoon, whatever you may call it. So they don't really understand you not having £5 in your pocket, because they never were short of £5. And that is what you can see here with all these cuts. It's not that they are doing it. It's what they are.
Well, what they're trying to say, I think, is that there's two classes of poor people. There's a deserving poor and an undeserving poor.
Well, I mean, there is very minority people who always take advantage of the system. But majority of these people, they're genuine, they need support, and a society and community will not be growing and will not be better off, and we will not be sharing our wealth and all this without helping these people. The people who needs help, you must help them. That this government is, the ideology of this government is, as I said, and I'm sure the Martin was saying that as well, that unless you feel the heat of certain things, you don't understand what it is. The government has never been through this. Prime Minister and his colleagues has never been through this kind of situation, that families are short of £5, they're short of children meals, they cannot buy children meals. So what they do, they go to the shops and steal mothers. They cannot buy children clothes, they go out to the shops and they steal clothes. This is what happening. The crime's increasing. Even in this city, we had about 6 to 10 burglary within last couple of weeks that I know of. And there are major burglaries happen. Police cut, child benefit cut, all sorts of cut. I mean, I think the government should have this decency to understand that what it means when you don't have anything in your pocket. And they would not understand. Let me tell you that. They would not understand. I say to my my colleagues and a lot of politicians, I say, you know, this is why one of the things that you look at, they look at the support, the people who support Tory party, Conservative party. You see most people is from middle class onwards. You don't see people below that. Why? People have this, you know, like things in their mind, this perception in their mind that, I mean, they're not going to help us. And they're not helping you. They're not helping people of this country with all this, you know. I mean, only a young mother would know what this cut means.
Marcy Summers, this is rather linked, I think, to what we were hearing from Rowan Williams, isn't it? This whole idea of the deserving and undeserving poor. And to be fair to the Conservatives, the idea here is to really pick out the lazy people and force them into work.
Into jobs that don't exist because they're cutting back the economy. Yeah, I mean, yeah. What are they talking about? It's absurd, frankly, and I think it's really disgusting that at a time when bankers' bonuses are being paid, we're bombing the crap out of various countries at the cost of millions, we are the poorest people in the society are being asked to take the sacrifices. Now, this is desperately unfair, but it's also completely stupid, because if you cut people's benefits in a recession like this, then they won't go and spend their money in the local shops, the businesses. Yeah. That's so if you live in a poor area, then if in actual fact what you're saying is the local businesses in that poor area are going to have their takings go down, because these are the people who come in their shops and buy the things. And of course that then means that the economy goes down the drain even further, and then the deficit goes up. The deficit is going up as a result of the policies being pursued, and this I think is going to be their undoing before the end of the year. By the end of the year it's going to be obvious that the deficit is bigger than ever, and we're going to lose our credit rating, just like Spain, just like Portugal, just like Ireland, just like Greece. And once we get there, people will realise that wealthy as they are, these people do not know what they are doing. I used to teach A-level economics. Do you know what? I'd give them all C-.
Now, I'm just going to give some apologies for Marty's swearing there. But we'll move on to our next story. Yesterday, Attorney General Dominic Grieve announced the result of legal action to get a proper inquest opened into the strange death of Iraq weapons inspector Dr. David Kelly. And here's Dominic Grieve speaking in the House of Commons now.
Mr. Speaker, having given all the material that's been sent to me the most careful consideration,
I have concluded that the evidence that Dr. Kelly took his own life is overwhelmingly strong. Further, there is nothing I've seen that supports any allegation that Dr. Kelly was murdered or that his death was the subject of any kind of conspiracy or cover-up. In my view, no purpose would be served by my making an application to the High Court for an inquest, and indeed I have no reasonable basis for doing so. There is no possibility that at an inquest, a verdict other than suicide would be returned. It isn't possible, in the short time I have now, to explain in detail the reasoning behind my conclusions.
That was, in fact, Dominic Grieve, Attorney General, speaking yesterday in the House of Commons. And one of the surgeons, doctors, that brought the legal action in order to try and force a proper inquest, because the original inquest was stopped after just one hearing by the Oxfordshire coroner, Nicholas Gardiner, is the trauma surgeon, David Halpin. So let's hear what he had to say.
I'm a very experienced trauma and orthopaedic surgeon. I was used to dealing with people, poor young people mostly, who'd cut their wrists in an attempt to end their lives. They don't end their lives by cutting their wrists. That's a fact. And the thing is that... please go on.
I'm getting older and my train of thought sometimes... You've been very clear, David Halpin, thank you.
Right.
Just a final thought. The judicial review that you say you will will be put in place, just tell us what happens now
What I'd like to say is, actually, if I can just say this, Sheila, is my last words on this. Dr. Delia's death, whether caused by his hand or by someone else, was all about the war in Iraq. Our plea for a second inquest, based on a mountain of incontrovertible evidence, has been refused by the Right Honourable Dominic Grieve, QC, the government's foremost law officer. He voted very strongly for the war in Iraq. You can refer to the Public Whip website for that. It is abundantly clear, given the obvious conflict of interest, that he should have disqualified himself from judging this plea on legal, constitutional, and moral grounds. I wrote this last night, and I've added, we will persist, and truth will out. Our great country is mired in mendacity, that is, lies. Its people yearn for the triumph of principle, and we will persist, and the truth will come out.
So that was David Halpin there speaking to Sheena Fogarty yesterday on BBC Radio 5 Live. Let's start with you, Martin, on this one. What Halpin's saying there essentially is that because he voted very strongly for the Iraq war, that actually Dominic Grieve should not be making this decision. He should take a step back and let another legal officer who was not involved in the decision to go to war with Iraq make that decision.
I think that's probably right. What's extraordinary about this case, absolutely extraordinary, is that if any untoward death happens like this anywhere in the country, the rule book is absolutely clear. You have a coroner's inquest in which all the evidence is brought forward. What happened in this case is, after one day, the coroner's inquest was closed down and we had a public inquiry, the Hutton inquiry, which started off with the presumption that he had committed suicide and questioned people with what sort of pressure he was under, why did he commit suicide. It's not been proved that he did commit suicide. And we've got a whole series of doctors, professional people, saying you can't commit suicide like that, it's just not feasible. You saw David Halpin saying there, it's virtually impossible to commit suicide by cutting your own wrists. Virtually impossible. Most people don't realise this, but it's true. And Dr. Chris Burns Fox here from French A Hospital has been leading the campaign on this as well. I think it's absolutely disgraceful that there's not been a coroner's inquest. And if the coroner's inquest uncovers that he did not commit suicide, then we've got a murder investigation, haven't we? A murder investigation. Is it the case that senior people like Dr. David Kelly can be murdered in cold blood in front of our eyes and nothing is done about it? Because that is the slippery slope to fascism.
Now, Labour councillor Mahmoud Khan from Eastfield, what are your thoughts about the David Kelly thing? Has it gone on too long? Should we just draw a line under it?
Well, it's gone a bit long, but I think if we are demanding, if some people are demanding, and a doctor like him demanding, I think there should be an inquest. Let's listen to it. Let's find the fact, and let's close this chapter. I mean, by doing the right thing, rather than, you know, like we're trying to jump and here, there, and not finding the right thing. I think it would be wise to do it for the government and for the people of the, so that the people know the truth.
Now, there's lots of problems over in the Middle East, as we know. There's been the Arab Spring, but particularly this week, we want to have a little look at Syria and Yemen. And here is Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday this week, and David Cameron asking a question about Syria.
Order. Questions to the Prime Minister.
Number one, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm sure the whole House will wish to join me in paying tribute to the following brave servicemen who've died in Afghanistan since we last met. Colour Sergeant Kevin Fortuna and Rifleman Martin Lamb from 1st Battalion, the Rifles. Lieutenant Oliver Augustin, Marine Samuel Alexander and Lance Corporal Martin Gill from 4-2 Commando, Royal Marines. And Corporal Mike Pike from the 4th Battalion, the Royal Regiment of Scotland. All of them were dedicated professionals serving our country. Their deaths are a reminder of the very high price that we are paying to stop Afghanistan from being a haven for terrorists. We honour their memory, we will support their families, we will not forget their service and their sacrifice.
Yeah. Jackie Doyle Price.
Can I associate myself with the Prime Minister's tribute to our fallen soldiers? We do indeed owe them a great debt. And Mr. Speaker, we are reminded on a daily basis that not everyone in the world is as fortunate as us in the freedoms that we enjoy in this country. And in particular, I'd like to highlight the absolute horror of the images of the 13-year-old boy who was tortured by the forces of the Syrian government in the recent weeks. Will the Prime Minister give me his assurance that he will use every influence he has to ensure the international community condemn the activities of the Syrian government and the demand that their reign of terror ends?
Minister. I think the Honourable Lady has spoken for the whole House in what she said about those dreadful pictures of that poor boy. There are credible reports of 1,000 dead and as many as 10,000 detained, and the violence being meted out to peaceful protesters and demonstrators is completely unacceptable. Of course, we must not stand silent in the face of these outrages, and we won't. In the EU, we've already frozen assets and banned travel by members of the regime, and we've now added President Assad to that list. But I believe we need to go further, and today in New York, Britain and France will be tabling a resolution at the Security Council condemning the repression and demanding accountability and humanitarian access. And if anyone votes against that resolution or tries to veto it, that should be on their conscience.
Yeah. Ed Miliband.
So that was Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday. Martin, President Assad is being condemned there by David Cameron, and what's going on in Syria being brought attention to. Possibly another and even more draconian than the present seizure of assets resolution at the United Nations. So what are your thoughts about Syria?
Well, it's hard to know what's actually happening. Everybody thinks they know what's going on, but frankly, we don't.
Well, journalists are banned from the country.
Well,
now.
Indeed. And therefore, we're all jumping to conclusions on the basis of very little evidence. I'm quite sure people are being repressed in Syria. The Syrians are saying that their security forces are coming under attack from armed rebels. Now, we know for a fact that the Western powers were colluding with the rebels in Libya last year, before the Arab Spring began. I've mentioned this before. People can look this up on websites.
But that's Libya, not Syria.
No, let's just get this clear. Operation Southern Mistral 2011 is all on the French Air Force website. It was a planned attack on Libya, and the rebels in Libya quite clearly have been armed and trained by the West before the Arab Spring began. Now, when people tell lies one time, you start to think, well, what other lies are they telling? The Syrians are saying, and if you look where the unrest in Syria is, it's on their border with Turkey and on their border with Jordan, where infiltrators from outside the country could get in. Now, I don't know what's going on. I wouldn't pretend to know what's going on. I condemn all repression by everybody. I condemn the repression in Bahrain. I condemn the repression of what's going on there. When are we going to say, we tried to kill Colonel Gaddafi and we killed one of his children the other week.
Three of his grandchildren.
When are we going to kill the King of Bahrain and the King of Saudi Arabia, because they repress their people? And if we're going to start killing people, then we're going to war. W-A-R. We're going to start killing people. Let's start killing, eh? Now, don't forget that that's a two-way street. You start killing other people's leaders, they're going to say, right, we're going to start killing you. The Russians are totally unhappy with all of this. The Chinese are unhappy with it. The South Africans are unhappy with it. We think that we've got the moral high ground. That's not how the rest of the world looks at it. In Colombia, they found 10,000 people dead in a grave last week. They are our allies. They are trained by the British Army. 10,000 dead. We went to war with Saddam because he killed his own people. Uribe and Colombia killed 10,000 of his own people, just 10,000 we found last week. And I was a trade union delegate to Colombia in 2004, so I know what I'm talking about. These people are hypocrites, bloody hypocrites.
But back to Syria, there's another story about a gay girl in Damascus, or a cynical hoax. A very strange story, this one. There was nothing at first sight to indicate the website was not exactly as it appeared. A young woman living in Damascus with dual US and Syrian citizenship, blogging in passionate, moving and deeply personal terms about her life as a lesbian and political activist living through the events of the Arab Spring. And what we heard, though, was that actually it was a completely fake website, even though this had been all around the world. And it was actually the photographs of a woman who lived in London that were used on the website. Now, ever since it's been discovered that this was a fake website, and it certainly seems like that, there's been nothing posted on there at all. So do you think that maybe all the social media that are being used in the Arab Spring, there's been manipulation going on in there? And if so, who might be doing it?
I think it's undoubtedly the case. That's why we can't believe anything we're being told. In war, the first casualty is truth. You can't believe what any of these people say. I don't believe what President Assad says. I don't believe what David Cameron says. I just don't believe any of them.
Mahmoud Khan, you're Labour councillor for Eastville. What are your thoughts about the whole sort of Arab Spring business, and maybe specifically about where it might be heading?
Well, it's certainly not heading towards a good direction. If you look at the repression and all this, what happened in, what done by Mugabe, nobody is talking about it. Nobody, everything is gone now, you know. But I understand if Libya and Syria and other Arab nations leaders are doing anything wrong, there are other ways of doing it, dealing with it. But I think what's happening, obviously I do condemn anybody is torturing any civilian or any oppression happening. But I think we need to be cautious about it. We need to be careful what we're doing, what we're saying. And it's not going to bring us benefit to destabilize those countries, you know. And as Martin rightly said, that if we want to deal with it, then obviously we need to deal with, we need to bring democracy in Saudi as well. We need to bring democracy in Bahrain as well, and the other countries. So I think there are certain things that involve here much more than just freeing people, as we all know. So I think that the governments here and all of us, we need to be careful what we're doing, what we're saying. We don't want to be end up killing like Dr. Kelly, and we don't want to be Saddam Hussein gone, I'm happy, but look where we are. Afghanistan, the dictators and the all these terrorists has gone, we are happy, but look where we are. You know, you don't want to create, you don't want to do things that by saying that we want to free people, and then you then put people in trouble situation.
But that's not really what's happening in Syria right now. We've got journalists banned from the country. And actually what's happening is the president is using his army, it seems, to repress the people.
But
surely this is a job for the police.
We don't know what's going on, Tony.
You know, from these countries, journalists are always almost banned. You never had the truth, you know. But now, okay, it's maybe a bit more. But where we are, when, you know, like, it's always like, I think sometimes what they say is like, you know, when it suits us, or if we want to do something, or, you know, in some cases, I mean, like, I don't want to go too details on it, but if you look into it, like, his regime, his father regime is there for last 40-50 years, and you know, the people always been suppressed, and people always been killed and deprived their rights and all this. But you know, we never talk about it. Suddenly now this Arab Spring and all this happening, you know, I think we must be careful what we're doing.
Okay, well, that's enough for the international stuff. Now let's go back and look at home. It's Prince Philip's 90th birthday today, as well as wishing
happy
him
birthday
a happy birthday,
yes.
Like when one would any of his commoners. Here is an antidote to those dreadful BBC interviews by Alan Titchmarsh and Fiona Bruce. I'm being a little bit biased there, but they dared not ask him any awkward questions, like maybe why he refused to give evidence at the Diana inquest, despite being a suspect. So here is an extract from Keith Allen's film about the Diana inquest, entitled Unlawful Killing, and it's all about Prince Philip. After a listen to this, you may decide for yourself why this film is being shown all around the world but is banned here in Britain.
Well, the enemy was my husband's department. I was a problem. What do we do with her?
This little boy is called Philip. His full name is Philip Schleswig Holstein Sonderberg Glücksberg, and he grew up in Germany. He was raised amongst his Nazi in-laws, some of whom later became high-ranking members of the SS. His Nazi relatives then sent him to this school in southern Germany, where he studied for a while under the Nazi curriculum. Philip later recalled that there was much heel-clicking and shouts of Heil Hitler were compulsory. And here's Philip, in Darmstadt, in the heart of Germany, in November 1937, attending a family funeral for some of his Nazi in-laws. Marching in front of a Sieg Heiling crowd, this is Philip, next to Christoph, his SS brother-in-law, and Philip, his Nazi stormtrooper brother-in-law. Imagine if a man with a past like this had somehow ended up marrying into British aristocracy. Well, he did. And as we know, he got first prize. He became the Duke of Edinburgh, also known as Prince Philip, after marrying Princess Elizabeth, the future Queen of England. Philip buried his Nazi past and became a respectable member of British royalty. And his story has continued happily ever after. Apart from a few family troubles that were quickly resolved. In the years before Princess Diana was killed, she told many people that the British establishment was planning to eliminate her.
Oh, of course Diana was bumped off. She knew she was going to be bumped off. She always says she's not going to make old bones.
Diana had left a note saying that she thought that somebody was going to kill her and that it would be in a car accident.
When a woman left a note saying, FYI, if I'm dead, here's how it's going to happen, and then it happens exactly like that, I think someone should pay attention.
Well, new Labour councillor for Eastfield, Mahmoud Khan, are you a big fan of Prince Philip?
He's a nice man. He's a nice man. You know, what shall I say on his 90th birthday? I would say happy birthday to him.
Okay, Martin?
Can I just say that the Queen did a fantastic job in Ireland the other week. I was very pleased with her performance, and she is an absolute trooper. She did everything right. She said exactly the right things, and everybody was really happy with the job that she did for Britain there. But Prince Philip had to go with the gaffer tape over his mouth because he's a bit of a liability.
And what do you think about the censorship of this film, the Keith Allen's film, Unlawful Killing?
Well, you can't censor things like this. I mean, we've just heard an extract from it now. No doubt anybody can go and find it on the internet and watch it. So in this day and
age, you can watch parts of it on the internet.
Well, I mean, basically, the idea that you can ban films in a country, it's all over, that is, isn't it?
What do you think about the censorship of this film, Mahmoud?
Would have been nice if we could watch it.
Our final story today, a Bristol nightclub, Lakota, has been told to close for 2 weeks after Joe Simons' death. It's claimed that 16-year-old Joe Simons from Bath took ecstasy during a night out with friends at the Lakota Club in Stokes Croft on the 30th of April. At a Bristol City Council licensing subcommittee hearing held yesterday, club owner Marty Burgess admitted mistakes had been made on the night Joe died, but insisted there was a zero-tolerance rule on drugs in the club. A witness statement from one of Joe's best friends was also read out. It said that the 16-year-old gifted student from Bitton had used cannabis before and tried MDMA for the first time in March on a night out at Lakota. The statement also said a group of four 16-year-olds managed to gain entry to Lakota and they bought the drugs inside. They then planned to do the same at the next trance event on the 30th of April. Do you think this is adequate, Mahmoud, very briefly, stopping them for 2 weeks after this chap's death?
Well, I mean, 2 weeks, I think 2 weeks is not the matter. Matter is need to be dealt properly, need to be seen how they got access to this ecstasy and take it forward. I mean, it's important we lost a young man and we cannot do it like this.
Okay, well, that's coming up. We're coming now to the Sky News at 6, thanks to this week's guest you just heard there, newly elected Labour councillor for Eastfield, Mahmoud Khan. After the news, if you've never heard of the annual Bilderberg Conference, it's because, like bankers or the Wizard of Oz, they want to stay out of the spotlight. The amazing thing is most of our press go along with the cover-up. The West's 120 richest bankers, bosses and royalty are schmoozing politicians, including our Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, today, inside a secret annual four-day conference in Switzerland. More after the news.
FM. It is your voice and it is your...
toys.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.